That fell, and, Your Honors, we believe that this one should fall. But the fact of the matter is that none of these 300 other permits, as far as the EPA has told us, would be endangered in any way whatsoever by saying, in this case, the EPA has to have standards before they delegate responsibility for creating enforcement to the regulated industry.
Okay,
thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Greenberg, are you next? Just as a preliminary question, I just wonder, do you have any observations about the standing of both of those parties?
Yes, Your Honor. Alan Greenberg from the U.S. Department of Justice on behalf of the respondent EPA. At counsel table on the far side is Michael Lee of the Office of General Counsel of EPA. Yes, I will first address standing, Your Honor. With respect to the oil and gas industry petitioners, we acknowledge that they have standing. And that is in part based upon our view of what the deferral rule does and our view of what the construction general permit does. From EPA's view, oil and gas petitioners' members have been subject to the construction general permit requirements and the obligation to get permits for stormwater discharges since 1992, at least for those members who were disturbing more than 5 acres. That was the threshold that was established in 1990 and then implemented or addressed by the construction general permit that was first issued in 1992. In 1999, EPA expanded the universe of construction operators that were required to obtain permits for discharge to those operators that disturbed 1 to 5 acres. And now we're not just talking about oil and gas. We're talking about all construction operators, residential, commercial, warehouses, oil and gas. EPA heard from the oil and gas industry that there were issues specific to oil and gas operators that needed to be addressed. And that is what prompted EPA to issue the deferral rule. A deferral rule, as its name implies, is a deferral. It postpones a pre-existing obligation. The oil and gas petitioners who were disturbing 1 to 5 acres would otherwise have had to obtain permit coverage on March 10, 2003. As a result of the deferral rule, that obligation has been postponed until March 10, 2005. From our point of view, the oil and gas petitioners' members that are disturbing over 5 acres are currently obligated to get some kind of permit coverage if they are discharging stormwater, and that would give them standing to raise challenges to the construction general permit. Turning to NRDC, we being the United States, did not challenge NRDC's standing. This was due in part due to the 30-year history that EPA has with NRDC relating to stormwater regulation and our general knowledge of who their members are and their efforts to establish standing in prior cases. So as a result, we did not make a standing argument. In reviewing their declarations, the standing question becomes much closer. We had assumed that they would establish that some of their members lived near bodies of water that were being affected by construction operators who were seeking coverage under a general permit. And they may, in fact, have such members, and that would give them standing to challenge this case under the citations, the cases that counsel for NRDC cited. If NRDC has members who are using bodies of water that are receiving stormwater discharges from construction sites that are covered or have sought coverage under the construction general permit, and the allegation is that that construction general permit is not adequate, and thus the water quality is worse than it otherwise would be, I believe under applicable precedent, they would have standing.
Now, has that been in use for 2 years, or just about?
The construction general permit? It has been in place for about a year now, Your Honor.
Okay, so there would be at least some possibility of that.
There would be some possibility of that.
But that hasn't been spelled out. And the individual members who are affected are not identified.
They submitted declarations of four members who indicated that they lived in states or the District of Columbia that would generally have construction operators who would seek coverage under a construction general permit, because the construction general permit is applicable in the various states in the District of Columbia in which the declarants reside.
So, but it was more general, more of a hypothetical, not because they actually were affected concretely, like in the examples you gave when they've had standing.
It's a close call, Your Honor. I did not see that the declaration said there is construction operator A up the street from me who has coverage under a general permit, and I see the mud running down the gutter. They did state that I live in geographic areas in which I think fair to say probably construction operations in those geographic areas.
And then in terms of the sort of the 30-year historical relationship, when it's been that fact scenario that you have described, courts have held that they've had standing?
I don't recall that standing was expressly raised in those cases or addressed by the courts in the opinions. It is true that EPA and NRDC have litigated for many years, and certain cases the standing is expressly addressed, and certain cases it has not been expressly addressed.
Thank you.
I would like to first address NRDC's arguments, and then with my second half of my argument, I will address the oil and gas petitioners' points. NRDC wants site-specific stringency added to the construction general permit, and that stringency simply is not required by the Clean Water Act. NRDC, in essence, is challenging valid assumptions and requirements that have been part of the NPDES program for almost 40 years since it started, and I'm going to identify three of those basic assumptions for the court. The first is what I call discharger expertise. NRDC argues, quote, that under the construction general permit, dischargers are experts in construction, not in complying with water quality standards. Well, the same thing could be said of miners who are experts in finding ore, or in aquaculturists who are experts in raising fish, and any of the other industries that are required to get NPDES permits. Yet all of them are required to develop the means to comply with permits and the water quality standards that are in those permits. It is the obligation of the discharger to read the permit, figure out what's required, and implement the necessary means to meet the standards in the permit.
How are the operators to know whether their SWIPs comply with the water quality standards?
The operators will need to do a couple things. First, they will have to determine what the applicable water quality standards are. Each state establishes designated uses for water and water quality criteria. These are in regulations that that each state promulgates. And the operator will need to either look them up or call somebody at the state or the local entity and find out what the applicable standard is, and then determine what he or she must do to meet that particular standard. Those standards can vary. In certain cases, there will be waters that have TMDLs, and Your Honor raised that point. The operator will have to call the state, find out if there's a TMDL applicable to that water, find out if there's a waste load allocation that allocates pollutants among the various sources that are discharging to that water, and determine what he or she must do to meet that standard. EPA has provided guidance to assist operators. Depending on the sophistication of the operator may have to hire somebody to assist him or her to develop the appropriate best management practices. But that's no different than any other operator under a general or an individual permit. Either they have the expertise or the law essentially requires them to hire someone to assist them to figure out what they have to do to comply with the standards. The second point, or the second assumption, is what NRDC calls the honor system that is in place here, and what I would characterize as a standard regulatory approach. All government programs establish requirements. The regulated entity must comply with those requirements, and if they don't, they're subject to enforcement. And that's what we have with Clean Water Act permits. The construction general permit establishes requirements, and contrary to NRDC's council's representation, there are requirements here. There are sediment basins. There are silt fences. There are velocity dissipation controls. And then there are the inspection requirements. There are the detailed requirements relating to final stabilization after your earth-moving activities have been completed. And there is the requirement in the general permit that the operator must design, select, and implement those BMPs, best management practices, that are necessary to meet water quality standards.
But the general permit doesn't establish specific case-by-case technology-based limits as required by the Clean Water Act, does it?
The permit does contain technology-based limits. Those are the sediment basins, the velocity controls, the silt fences. They are not case-by-case. They are done, in the case of a general permit, on a general permit basis. These are the technology-based standards that, in EPA's judgment, are necessary to meet the technology requirements of the Act. Those do not have to be on a case-by-case. The thrust of NRDC's argument is that the water quality standard component should be done on a case-by-case. And the reason for that is that receiving waters vary by site to site. Some are going to be cleaner, some are going to be less clean, some are going to have different water quality criteria, some are drinking water sources, some are sources for irrigation water. And because of those different uses, there are different requirements applicable to a discharger to those waters. As a result, operators under the general permit will be likely installing different best management practices at different sites. The site in arid New Mexico likely will have different best management practices than a lakeshore development in New Hampshire. But that flexibility is necessary if this general permit is going to be viable, and there is nothing illegal about doing the approach EPA has taken, because EPA has set forth the requirement in the permit: you shall implement BMPs as necessary to meet water quality standards. That is an enforceable requirement in the permit.
And then they're obligated to determine what those standards are based on the locality?
And then the operator would have to determine what those standards are based on the locality.
Can I talk to you about this notice of intent? Because one of your positions is it's just an item of procedural correspondence. And so what I want to know is, what is it that the EPA and other interested federal, state, and local regulators review during the seven-day period after the NOI is filed? What is there to alert them that during that period that maybe they should object to allowing a particular operator to discharge stormwater?
The seven-day period was installed as part of the construction general permit as a result of EPA's consultation with the services, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Services, under the Endangered Species Act. And that seven-day window is to allow the services to review the NOI to determine if there are potential Endangered Species Act concerns.
And Mr. Sullivan says nobody reviews that.
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Services have the opportunity to review them. I don't know whether they're reviewing all of them, some of them. The idea is that the notice of intent states the location of the discharge to be authorized under the permit. So the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service can look at that location, and if they're aware that there are endangered species or critical habitat at that location, they can raise a red flag and say, put a hold on that authorization. There may be potential Endangered Species Act concerns that need to be addressed before discharges can be authorized under that permit.
Now, who has to get that notice?
The notice of intent is received by EPA and is currently posted on an electronic database, and so you...
That's how the interested agencies would access it.
That is how the interested agencies would access it. Yes, Your Honor. The third point that I did want to raise relating to NRDC's assumptions relates to the inspection program. Inspections are meaningful. The inspectors are required under the general permit to be qualified in both the erosion and sediment control practices that are to be required and in being able to assess whether they are effective. And the kicker is they have to certify when they go out to inspect every 7 or 14 days, depending on which regimen the operator chooses. They have to either identify where BMPs are not working and provide corrective measures, or certify under penalty of perjury that the permittee, the discharger, is in compliance with the construction general permit. That is an important and effective means, combined with all of the other measures in the construction general permit, to ensure that the discharges are going to meet the technology and water quality-based standards of the permit. There is an important distinction here between EPA's obligation as permit writer and the operator's obligation to comply with the permit. And we touch on this on our brief, and NRDC's counsel mentioned it in his argument. EPA does not have a duty to ensure compliance with the permit. EPA has a duty as the permit writer to issue a permit that contains terms that comply with the Clean Water Act, which it has done here. It is the obligation of the discharger to make sure he or she complies, and EPA then has enforcement tools that support that compliance obligation. Here we are dealing with the permit. We are not dealing with enforcement. And that's an important distinction, and it's one that we believe the Ninth Circuit did not fully appreciate in their Environmental Defense Center decision. The permit here has to contain the requirements, which it does, and whether dischargers do or do not comply is not EPA's responsibility other than to enforce the permit terms in the event they don't comply.
And then that would be the result of some complaint or some other alert that, someone didn't
It would
comply.
Be the result of an EPA inspection.
Oh,
EPA,
so they do inspect. Then.
We do inspect. We certainly don't inspect every construction operator. We have ongoing enforcement actions against various home builders. We had an enforcement action against Walmart. I'm sure the interveners will be happy if they choose to tell you about how their clients are regulated and enforced against under this general permit. But yes, we do. EPA does have inspectors that go out and identify violations of the construction general permit. Unless you have further questions on NRDC, I will turn to the arguments of the oil and gas petitioners. Actually, before I leave NRDC, I wanted to make one other point. The court asked, what does NRDC really want? And they said, and they responded, they want to vacate the general permit. And I guess the next question is...
They wanted an injunction.
They wanted an injunction that would find the general permit unlawful.
Right.
And essentially would
stop you from issuing it.
We issued one, and so then the question is, what do we have in its place? And I think if you really read their brief closely, what you end up with is something very close to requiring EPA, if you accept NRDC's arguments, to have an individual permit system. Because they want a permit that is tailored to the water quality standards at a specific site. They want a permit that's tailored to the particular TMDL at a particular site. They want a permit that's tailored to the particular anti-degradation standards at a particular site. And as a practical matter, because all of those things vary from site to site, we will have an individual permit system. Council talked about watershed-based systems. Begs the question, what watershed? Certainly the Mississippi River watershed would not be viable because there are all sorts of different water quality standards applicable in the Mississippi River watershed. What you get down to is very small water body segments because water quality standards vary by small water quality segments. I would now like to turn to the oil and gas industry position. In addressing the oil and gas industry petition, it's important to understand what the construction general permit does and does not do. The construction general permit does not establish whether you need a permit. That has already been established in prior regulations and in the prior regulations. What the construction general permit does is establish terms and conditions for those people who are obligated to get a permit to tell them how they should act, what measures they need to take to comply with the Clean Water Act. So it's a how. What we have done here with the construction general permit, what EPA has done, is set up a permit that meets Clean Water Act requirements yet is flexible enough to be used at various construction sites, including those sites by the oil and gas industry. It's also important to note that contrary to the oil and gas industry allegations, this permit doesn't impose requirements on anybody. It is a choice of a permittee to seek coverage under the general permit. I acknowledge that the vast majority of construction operators do seek coverage under the general permit because it's the easiest route to go. Most people find it a manageable set of requirements and much more efficient than applying for an individual permit. But that doesn't mean that EPA, in this construction general permit, has to include terms and conditions that will satisfy every possible discharger from a construction site throughout this country. That would simply be impossible. And this construction general permit should not be found arbitrary and capricious simply because there may be dischargers in the regulated community who don't find that the construction general permit is meeting his or her needs. Judge Williams asked about EPA's decision to respond to comments and did we respond to all the comments. EPA responded to the comments submitted by the oil and gas industry that addressed the construction general permit itself and the common plan issue. There were numerous, I think in our brief we said 30, over 30 oil and gas industry comments on common plan, and EPA responded to those substantively. Oil and gas industry folks commented on final stabilization, and we responded. What EPA did not respond to were comments that went to the question of whether somebody needed a permit. That is a question that is going to be before the Fifth Circuit in the deferral rule. The construction general permit doesn't address whether you need a permit. And the oil and gas industry comments that went to whether you needed a permit, whether they were exempt, for example, under 402L, or whether there were special circumstances that would require a different regulatory regime for oil and gas. those are issues that we're going to be responding to, EPA will be responding to in the deferral rule rulemaking. And for that reason, we did not address them in this particular proceeding. I think if the court carefully looks at the record and at the comments that EPA responded to and that didn't respond to, that will become clear. I think just reading the brief, you recognize that EPA responded to many comments relating to Common Plan. The fact sheet addressed oil and gas industry issues relating to Common Plan. We provided examples about how the oil and gas industry and how the Common Plan would apply to certain oil and gas industry situations, alongside of how it would apply to airports, how it would apply to schools, how it would apply to residential construction. Each of those matters was addressed by EPA in the Common Plan discussion. I would note, however, in my last minute, that the question of Common Plan isn't before this court because EPA provided guidance related to Common Plan. It did not issue a rule establishing Common Plan requirements. I think if you read the context of those guidance, it's clear that EPA offered suggestions and examples. I see that my time is up. Unless the court has further questions, I urge the court to uphold the construction general permit against the challenges brought by both NRDC and the oil and gas petitioners. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Ellen Steen, Wisconsin Builders. And you're splitting your argument, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Builders? Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll first address the standing question, which was my plan anyway. The NRDC did offer some declarations only after its standing was challenged in our brief. Those declarations, however, don't rise to the occasion, a little bit to my surprise. They have yet to identify one member who claims harm from one project authorized under the construction general permit. There is only, in the declaration submitted, one statement by one of the declarants that does purport to identify a project authorized under the construction general permit, and that is the declaration of Jim Woodworth at paragraph 5, in which Mr. Woodworth claims that he knows that a project of 3.5 acres in the National Zoo in Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C., obtained authorization under the permit. He claims to know that the project area contained habitat of an endangered species known as the Hayes Spring amphipod, and he claims that the construction operator, who's unnamed, obtained authorization on a false statement that there were no endangered species present in the project area. But what's just as important as what Mr. Woodworth says is what he doesn't say. He doesn't say the basis of any of this knowledge, which apparently isn't EPA's NOI's database because no such project appears in EPA's database. He doesn't say that the project actually occurred as opposed to, for example, being halted as a result of species concerns raised during the 7-day review period. He doesn't say that there was any stormwater discharge from this alleged project. So, at best, the only claim that this could possibly go to would be the ESA claim, and yet, for that, it still falls short because Mr. Woodworth doesn't claim any cognizable interest related to the Hayes Spring amphipod. He doesn't claim to have ever seen one, to have ever tried to see one, to have ever hoped to see one in the future. And
kind of like a purple cow, I remember that poem.
Right, which it really, and if you look at the articles that he cites, it's not surprising because they actually live underground, and very few people other than Fish and Wildlife Service researchers have ever seen them. He claims only to have read about them and to be amazed that they exist only in this small area. That amazes me, too, but it doesn't give rise to a cognizable interest that can create standing. So the lack of any allegation of actual harm by any member associated with this permit relates not only to standing, but to the relief that NRDC has demanded as well. The failure to allege any harm to anyone, let alone irreparable harm, just isn't sufficient to support an extraordinary claim for injunctive relief like they've made. Broad allegations about stormwater pollution or even construction-related stormwater pollution generally just don't support a claim, let alone a claim for injunctive relief, against this general permit. This is not a challenge to the stormwater program. It's a challenge to this permit. Now, although NRDC's claims are specific to this permit, theoretically, it is a challenge to this permit, the collateral damage from a ruling in NRDC's favor would be vast. NRDC insists that it's not generally opposed to general permits, and it also suggests at their reply brief on page 3 that somehow this permit is exceptional. That is simply false. This permit is typical of the general permits that have been issued not only by EPA traditionally, but by all of the states, and that would be, I think it's 46 delegated states now. The vast majority essentially follow this model, an NOI followed by automatic coverage after some number of days unless the agency decides to intervene, an operator-designed plan that identifies site-specific measures to be implemented, and the Wisconsin, Indiana, and Illinois, the three states within the circuit, just to name a few, follow this model. Your Honor, my personal time is up, and I've promised to allow time for my colleague unless there are questions.
Okay, fine. And your colleague is
Mr. Longsworth.
Longsworth?
May it please the Court. Jeff Longsworth, Counsel to the Associated General Contractors. I'd like to address in my short time a couple of the issues that have either been raised by the panel or by NRDC. Judge Williams, you asked about the case-by-case determination. In the Clean Water Act, when they talk about a case-by-case determination, we interpret that to mean permit by permit, not discharge by discharge. So in terms of assessing the technology requirements within the construction general permit, that would be done for the permit itself, and that has been done, and that is done for all permits, and EPA is correct in that assertion. I'd also like to address the Ninth Circuit case, the Environmental Defense Council case. The construction general permit provides all that the Ninth Circuit thought was missing from the Phase 2 municipal program that EPA had set up. That program created a permit system without end goals or effluent limitations. It was purely a process. And the Ninth Circuit concern was that you walk through this process blindly to without any accountability either through EPA or the public with regard to final effluent quality. In other words, you walk through the process, you answer the questions, it didn't matter what your final discharge looked like. In the current construction general permit, on the other hand, the permit contains stringent goals and effluent limitations. Those goals and effluent limitations were vetted through the public notice and comment process, and I'd point out that this is the third cycle for notice and comment on the construction general permit since the first permit was issued. The Ninth Circuit also recognized the very unique nature of the municipal Phase 2 rule that it was asked to address, and specifically pointed out in a footnote that Phase 2 rule and model was substantially dissimilar to the traditional permit model. The construction general permit is, in fact, structured as those other traditional general permits. With regards to self-regulation, the construction general permit is not a self-regulating entity. It is not what NRDC called it in terms of a do-the-right-thing permit. It contains stringent end goals that are defined within the permit, and they must be met by each discharger, or that discharger is in violation of the permit. There are substantial penalties for violation. The end goals are defined through this public process, as I mentioned, and it's consistent throughout the entire NPD.